So this evening, I'd like to share a set of reflections that have been really on my mind for several weeks. And this is related to reflecting on the life and teachings and work of the great teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, who has had a very large impact on my own sense of practice and my own really vocation to connect practice with really all dimensions of life, with very much with daily life, to connect formal practice with daily life, to connect both of those with engaging in the larger world. And we explore these themes at a time when, as it were, the drumbeats of war are getting louder. And there's a very dangerous situation in the world. And I think, again, of Thich Nhat Hanh being in very, very difficult situations and bringing a sense of practice and compassion and interdependence very, very fully into the situation. And so I'll talk some about Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching. I also want to bring in my own personal experience meeting him. I met him first about 35 years ago. 1987, I went to a retreat at the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. I think at that time, I was living and working in rural Ohio. And I came back to the Insight Meditation Society, where I had been a practitioner for about the previous 10 years. And I had been very interested in the kind of retreats that were offered at Insight Meditation Society, similar to the retreats at Spirit Rock, where we would be in silence and sitting and walking, you know, 16, 18 or more hours a day, doing so for could be a week at a time. A lot of the early retreats at IMS were 10 days or 14 days. And I had really loved developing deeper concentration. And I came to this retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh. And I think we sat maybe three or four times a day. And the length of the sittings was 20 minutes. And you know, and there wasn't silence. And there was a fair amount of talking. We would do group walking meditation down the road we had about 100 people there. Yeah. And we would do walking meditation. There were a lot of children there, maybe 20 or more children, and they would be there as well. And I remember hearing some perspectives from some of the people who had been practitioners at IMS for a while, and that this was some kind of sort of light spiritual fare, that we were, you know, we weren't really doing the real thing. It was kind of a light thing. We were, you know, sitting there, and Thich Nhat Hanh would give two-hour talks a day. We do walking, you know, people would talk to each other. And I did not experience a retreat like ones I had experienced, you know, with deepening concentration, a great sense of silence and peace. But something else was happening that I hadn't really experienced before that was quite profound. And there was a sense of, increasingly, as the days went on and we received the instructions from Thich Nhat Hanh, there was a sense of having more and more a moment-to-moment experience of interdependence, what Thich Nhat Hanh called interbeing. I had a sense of being very closely and deeply connected to others, but it was also not just interconnection with the people, but we would also be invited during a meal to look closely at what we were eating. Can we be with vegetables and have a sense that this is not just a vegetable, but that we can have a sense of the soil or the farmer or the vegetables being brought to market, the whole web of causes and effects. And it became that kind of understanding increasingly moment by moment. And at the end of the retreat, I knew that I had experienced something profound, but it was different than what I had experienced at other retreats. And there was that sense of seeing the interdependence and interconnections, the web of causes and conditions, moment by moment. You can even tune into that kind of understanding now. Can you look at the different ones on the screen and have a sense of our interconnections being part of Marin Sangha? Can you look at your electronic screen and have a sense of some of the causes and conditions and materials and places which made this possible? Thich Nhat Hanh would typically start his 2-hour talks by gathering all the children in front of him, and he would talk with the children. And he would say, he would hold up, for example, an orange. He would hold up this orange and he said, and he would ask the children, can you see the clouds that led to the rain that gave the water to the oranges? And the children would say, yes, yes. Can you see the land where the oranges are growing? Where this orange was growing? Yes. You know, can you see the soil out of which the tree is growing? Yes. And he would go on like that, continually talking to the children for maybe 5 or 10 minutes. And then the children would go off. And then Thich Nhat Hanh would go to the non-profound material, so to speak. But not, actually, he would continue in that vein, because he was really teaching something like that to all of us. And it was also powerful in terms of a sense of interconnection that this was in 1987, and it was just about 12 years after the end of the Vietnam War. And about half the people there were Vietnamese. Almost all of the children were Vietnamese. And so at that time, maybe a little more than it would be now, the memories of the war or of seeing images of children terrified under the bombs. We actually saw at least one film which showed the B-52s dropping bombs in Vietnam. And so there was that kind of sense of interconnection also. You know, that was there. And this, I think, is one of the one of the core teachings that Thich Nhat Hanh gave. You know, tonight I want to combine a reflection on, I think, probably four of Thich Nhat Hanh's core teachings, of which the sense of interdependence and interbeing is the first one, you know, that I wanted to bring up. And very, very relevant for now. Thich Nhat Hanh also had this sense of interbeing very much in terms of war and peace. You know, that war and peace is not just decided on by a few of those in a particular government, but that whether there is war or peace also very much depends on us and depends on our voices and our perspectives. There's a very powerful sense of interbeing that Thich Nhat Hanh gave in 2016, so about 6 years before he died. He died, I think it was January 22nd, so just about 3 weeks ago. And he spoke about his own death in 2016. Some of you know he had had a stroke in 2014, and his health was clearly declining, had declined. And he reflected in this way, in another expression of this sense of interbeing. This body of mine will disintegrate, but my actions will continue me. If you think I am only this body, then you have not truly seen me. When you look at my friends, you will see my continuation. When you see someone walking with mindfulness and compassion, you know that person is my continuation. I don't see why we have to say I will die, because I can already see myself in you and other people and in future generations. Even when the cloud is not there, it continues as snow or rain. It is impossible for the cloud to die. It can become rain or ice, but it cannot become nothing. The cloud does not need to have a soul in order to continue. There is actually no beginning and no end. I will never die. There will be a dissolution of this body, but that does not mean my death. I will continue always. How is that to, as a perspective, to live every day? To have that sense of really being part of the web of life that, in a sense, is out of time and beyond this time or that time. To have connection with that and to have those other ways of developing a sense of interbeing, you know, with the objects in our life, with the people in our lives. Thich Nhat Hanh thought that mindfulness is really a key to this. We could say the slowing down, the moving out of being with the world in a almost entirely conceptually mediated way, but rather being more directly with our experience. So he saw that mindfulness and looking deeply were the keys. So I want now to bring in some of the story of Thich Nhat Hanh's life. And I'm going to do that through showing a whole sequence of photographs. Most of them are photographs of Thich Nhat Hanh. I'll also bring in photographs that I took when I visited Plum Village in 1992 and stayed, I think, for a few weeks in his community in the south of France. And then through looking at the history of Thich Nhat Hanh's life, I also want to bring out several other core themes. You know, one of them will be the theme of the necessity of Buddhist practice being engaged in the world. Another theme will be mindfulness. And then a further theme will be the sense of what he called in one of his books, being peace, that sense of in one's own being, expressing connection, nonviolence, the quality of peace. So I'll go to the screen sharing now. Can everyone see? Okay, very good. So this is a beautiful photo of Thich Nhat Hanh at age 16. He was born in Hue, which is in central Vietnam. And at 16, this would have been 1942. He was born in 1926. So this is him at age 16, entering a monastery as a novice monk. And then becoming at age 25, a full monk. 1951, many of you know the history. Many of the Vietnamese had thought that after World War II, they would have their freedom from the French. But the French kept their attempt to control Vietnam. And there was, as you know, a struggle, a military struggle that the Vietnamese actually won. Some of you know at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in 1954. Thich Nhat Hanh at that time, through the 1950s and 60s, was living a little bit differently than many of the monks. He was enrolled in the 1950s at the university. He studied some secular topics, one of the first monks to go to the university. He was involved in the efforts to revive Vietnamese Buddhism. And he was very innovative and creative. This is him teaching, I think, in the early 1960s to children, teaching about the Bodhisattva of compassion. And he was involved very much as the Americans took over the war. He was very involved in the attempts to bring peace to Vietnam. He talked at one point a little bit later about how he looked at things in those years. He said, when I was in Vietnam, so many of our villages were being bombed. Along with my monastic brothers and sisters, I had to decide what to do. Should we continue to practice in our monasteries or should we leave the meditation halls in order to help the people who were suffering under the bombs? After careful reflection, we decided to do both, to go out and help people and to do so in mindfulness. We called it engaged Buddhism. Mindfulness must be engaged. Once there is seeing, there must be acting. We must be aware of the real problems of the world. Then with mindfulness, we will know what to do and what not to do to be of help. And so he developed an order, which was called the Thiep Hien Order. I think it started in 1964, and I'll come back to that in a moment, which was a very powerful organization that really articulated Buddhist wisdom precepts and ethical precepts that would guide people being engaged in the peace movement in Vietnam. And a lot of his work that we'll explore a little later comes out of this very, very powerful period. He also founded a organization called the Buddhist, or the School of Youth and Social Service, which worked with 10,000 volunteers, again, following principles of nonviolence and compassion, to address the refugees, to address the war. In 1966, he came to the U.S. He got to know Dr. King, who would later, the next year, nominate him for the Nobel Peace Prize. They got to be friends. Dr. King would say, "Thich Nhat Hanh is a holy man. He is my friend." And it's generally thought that that friendship and that connection was a major impetus for Dr. King coming out publicly against the Vietnam War, as many of you know, on April 4th, 1967, in his talk at the Riverside Church in New York City, which led him to actually, not always well known, led him to become very unpopular. There were editorials in the New York Times, I think the Washington Post, saying that he had made a terrible blunder, effectively that civil rights and the anti-war movement shouldn't mix. He became actually very unpopular in the Black community, not very unpopular, but, you know, many, many, many critical voices. Thich Nhat Hanh would not have known that on this trip to try to help bring about peace in Vietnam, that he was not able after this trip to return to Vietnam for 39 years. The South Vietnamese government would not let him back, neither would the North Vietnamese government. So he was exiled in the West. He actually spent some time after this, actually in a number of different places. He spent time in France and Paris in the early 60s, the late 60s, early 70s. He was the lead person in the Buddhist delegation at the peace talks. He spent time in France. And he actually went through a period of time which was quite difficult in the period right after the end of the Vietnam War, 1975, 76, 77. He tried to help the so-called boat people, the people who were trying to flee Vietnam after the end of the war. And he helped in many ways, but he was then forbidden to enter several of the countries where the boat people were going. The governments of Thailand and Indonesia forbade him to be in their countries. And so there was really nowhere for him to go. So he went back to France and went into southern France near the land that would now later become Plum Village. And he entered a five-year period of retreat and reflection that really developed the impetus for what he would do later. So it was a challenging time. It's something useful to reflect on when we have transitions. You know, what do we do at a really difficult time? Thich Nhat Hanh chose to go into retreat and reflect more deeply. So I want to come back now to talking about another dimension of his work, which came out of the engaged Buddhism, which has really been impactful. And this is really an extension of the engaged Buddhist perspective in really reformulating the meaning of the ethical precepts. You know, we work a lot with the ethical precepts, you know, especially the five lay precepts, not to take life, not to take that which is not given, and to be very careful with sexuality, with our speech, and with substances which shift consciousness. Thich Nhat Hanh, for this organization called the Order of Interbeing, gave a very powerful interpretation of the ethical precepts that we could say was an engaged understanding, which has really influenced me tremendously. He wanted to say that these guidelines about not harming others, not killing, not taking that which is not given, are not just something guiding our face-to-face behavior in our own personal interactions, but they also come into how we relate to the larger world. For example, the first guideline about not killing, Thich Nhat Hanh later reformulated it like this: aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life, I vow to cultivate compassion and learn ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I am determined not to kill, not to let others kill, not to condone any act of killing in the world, in my thinking, my way of life. So he's saying, this is our responsibility. If we are practitioners, it's not just about not killing, it's about not letting others kill. He goes on to say, we cannot support any act of killing. No killing can be justified, but not to kill is not enough. We must also learn ways to prevent others from killing. We cannot say, I am not responsible. They did it. My hands are clean. If you were in Germany during the time of the Nazis, you could not say, they did it. I did not. If during the Gulf War, you did not say or do anything to stop the killing, you were not practicing this precept. And he also interpreted the others in very similar ways. The second precept, possess nothing that should belong to others. But he also said, prevent others from enriching themselves from human suffering or the suffering of other beings. Do not accumulate wealth while millions are hungry. Live simply and share time, energy, and material resources with those who are in need. So that's a challenge, isn't it? What is it like if we take on those precepts? If we understand following the precepts as not just about, again, our face-to-face behavior, but about how we relate to harm being done in the world. It changes our lives when we take that seriously. That's what I learned much more deeply from Thich Nhat Hanh. A challenge, though. And I'll come back now. I think I'll come back to his life. So here he is again on the land, which would become Plum Village, where he started in 1982 and eventually established a community. That's where I visited in 1992. He also continued to be active. This is him at a March for Disarmament in 1982. This is him at Plum Village, which became a very large community. When I was there, there was a lot of land, quite a number of people living there. It was about half Vietnamese, half people from probably from Europe and North America, as well as some from Asia. And these are next photographs for ones that I took. This is the land around Plum Village. All that yellow is basically sunflowers, people. And you'll see sunflowers a lot with Thich Nhat Hanh. So there's sunflowers everywhere. This is the part of the community. You can see the sunflowers. And this is Thich Nhat Hanh teaching when I was visiting there. and another image of him teaching. This is during in the dining hall, just basically hanging out. This is where he lived at Plum Village. Here is a little bit later are some photographs again from Plum Village, from his teaching. He loved to teach children and bring everyone together. This is again later in his life. I think this is from 2009, leading walking meditation. He was able to return to Vietnam in 2005 for the first time. He went back to the temple where he had been in Hue. And he traveled, this is in India at Vulture Peak, transmitting the ethical precepts that we just looked at. In London, 2012, teaching mindfulness to 3,000 people. Walking meditation at Plum Village. Later that year, he had a stroke and he declined some. But he did recover, but he knew, by this time he was close to his 90s, and he decided he wanted to live the rest of his life in Vietnam. So he went back to this village. You can see he's in a wheelchair there. And he went back to the village and lived in Vietnam at his temple from this time until the time of his death 3 weeks ago. Here's the funeral in Hue. And then the last photograph is that of, again, being carried at his funeral. We'll do the stop share. There's a wonderful website that Plum Village has where I got a lot of those photographs. So very, very, very wonderful. So a little bit more on the teachings and we can open things up to discussion. Mindfulness was right at the center, the sense of being present, to know our inner experience, to know what's happening, to be with our emotions in ways that are very much like most of the ways we practiced. But also he brought the mindfulness outwardly, to be with the orange, to be with the tree, to be mindful of larger relationships. So he really brought mindfulness, as it were, off the cushion, very fundamental part of his teaching. And he taught a lot about being with difficult emotions. He shared very much his own experiences of particularly being with issues of war and peace, and how he would work himself with anger or with the pain of certain situations, talking about working with difficult emotions with mindfulness. He talked, for example, a talk that I heard, which he gave in Berkeley right after the invasion of Iraq in, I think, 1991 or two, I forget, but that so-called first Gulf War. And he talked about his own anger, but he talked about how with mindfulness, he said, I practiced breathing, walking, and sitting. And a few days later, I decided to go to America. At first, he decided, I don't want to go to the U.S. because of this invasion. I saw that I was one with the American people, with George Bush, number one, and with Saddam Hussein. I had been angry with President Bush, but after breathing consciously and looking deeply, I saw myself as President Bush. He acted the way he did because we acted the way we did. Our society is filled with hatred and violence. We are all a part of the bomb that is waiting to explode. We are all co-responsible. Which really brings me to the last theme I wanted to bring up about how he pointed to how each of us can be peace. That this teaching of being peace is so fundamental. He questioned whether many people in the peace movement were actually full of peace or full of anger. He said there was a lot of anger in the peace movement. And he thought that it was very problematic for angry peacemakers to actually succeed. So he thought that, he said that peace is every step. Without being peace, we cannot do anything for peace. If we are not peaceful, then we cannot contribute to the peace movement. A fresh way of being peace is needed. We must look, see, and understand. Peace work means, first of all, being peace. He talked about how the peacemaker brings the pain of one side to the other side, and then the pain of the second side back to the first side. I could go on, but just to say, maybe in closing, that I've been deeply, deeply influenced by being with him, particularly when he would come to Berkeley and sometimes Spirit Rock. When I was working very closely with the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and he had a close connection with the Buddhist Peace Fellowship and really influenced how I thought and sort of the horizons of trying to develop engaged Buddhism in the West. One of the tremendous influences on all of our work, and still very, very, very much present. And so maybe I'll close by saying, when we are mindful, when we practice a sense of interbeing, when we develop peace ourselves, particularly in bringing that peace into difficult situations, we are really continuing the life of Thich Nhat Hanh. He is there really in us as we practice interbeing, develop mindfulness, be peace, and bring that sense of being peace to difficult situations. So let me finish with that. And thank you for listening and letting me reflect. I hope it came through even with the use of Zoom. So let's just sit for a moment and see what may have been important for you, anything you want to share, reflect on, ask a question. Let's take just a few quiet moments. So let me ask if there are any questions, any sharing of your own experience, maybe how Thich Nhat Hanh has influenced you, questions about his teaching, anywhere you'd like to go, sharing something from your own experience, asking me maybe about some of my own experience further with Thich Nhat Hanh. I should say that, you know, one thing I didn't mention is I've been also very influenced by knowing a Dharma heir of Thich Nhat Hanh named Thich Minh Duc, who I worked with when I was a graduate school teacher, and he became my student. And we would often go around and say, "This is my teacher." He would say that about me, and then I would say, "This is my teacher." And Thich Minh Duc had been in Vietnam, had to go in exile. He was a monk. He had been active with the engaged Buddhist movement, and he did a PhD dissertation with me as his advisor, which was on a history of engaged Buddhism in Vietnam, focusing on 1963 to 1965, but giving 1,000 years of history of engaged Buddhism in Vietnam, going back 1,000 years. And so that also had a big impact. And I would go with him, with Thich Minh Duc. We went a number of times into the Vietnamese communities in San Jose and then in Orange County in Southern California. He would sometimes have me give talks to the younger people so that they would have interest in Buddhism, because it wasn't, they didn't always listen to the older Vietnamese people. Anyway, that's a story. So Vita, please.
A couple things. First, thank you very much for this. And also for sharing so much about yourself. It really is nice to get that perception of you.
Yeah, thank you.
So yeah, really lovely. So two quick things. One, I think it must have been 2000. He was in Oakland, mm-hmm. and he did a peace walk and a teaching around Lake Merritt.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just seeing him even from afar was quite beautiful. And I'm wondering if you can tell us where we can find what you quoted from his 2016 speech about his in the body will deteriorate, but I'm still here.
Oh wow, yeah. Well, I have it. Would the easiest way for me to be send it to Corey and put it on the website? I could do that easily. You could. It's easily findable online.
Under what?
I would just use some lines of his. The first words were, "This body of mine will disintegrate." I imagine if you just use those words and add Thich Nhat Hanh, you'll get to it easily enough. But I'll send it also to Corey.
Thank you. I want to use it for my memorial. I want it included.
Oh, wow. Wow.
But thank you so much.
What a perspective to live with, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because we, even with all our practice, we can easily have this sense of being isolated, separate beings. I mean, that's what our practice is working on. And Thich Nhat Hanh is amazing to have, have more and more of that sense of interbeing. It changes things, and you can, it's pretty simple. Just go out and look at a tree and, be like the children that he was instructing. Look for the cloud in the tree. Very, very simple. But doing that a lot will change things.
I think, I've read a number of his writings, but I really got a real sense of that interbeing from your talk today.
Hmm.
Our responsibility, not for just feeling peace, but act, just a different perspective. And I thank you very much, Donald.
Yeah, thanks, Vita. Yeah, there are many levels, the interbeings there, moment-to-moment perception, reflection, but also ethically, as I brought out. Yeah. Thanks. Please.
You, sir. Deborah.
Deborah, please.
First of all, you evoked a lot of memories for me. Well, no, first of all, thank you. That was replete and it was lovely. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
And it evoked some memories for me because I wish my memory was as sharp and good as yours. I know I sat with Thich Nhat Hanh 1,000 years ago in Santa Cruz in the mountains somewhere. I don't even remember the center.
I was on that retreat. If it was the 90s, it was at, I think it was like at a yoga center in the Santa Cruz Mountains.
Yes, I remember that, not completely, but clearly what I do remember. And I remember the walk at Spirit Rock, and I remember buying his books and reading them, and the interbeing community. But I didn't know as much about his tribulations. I knew that he was exiled from Vietnam and because he tried to be a peacemaker, but I just really loved it. And I really appreciate your giving us that and giving me that. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. It was a pleasure. And I loved having access to all those amazing photographs. Yeah.
Seeing how did you get that?
Those, some of them were mine, but a lot of them were from the Plum Village website. Yeah.
Are they free to, say, put in our newsletter?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, Patty, please.
I also want to thank you. That was beautiful. But I want to say two things. I've lost two close family members recently. And this talk really felt like a healing balm. Quoting him on the deterioration of his body and how his life continues through others, that was so touching to me. And it reminded me of what I grew up hearing in the Reformed Jewish prayer book. When someone dies, they always said, "He still lives on earth in the acts of goodness he performed and in the hearts of those who cherish his memory." So I thank you for that. I also want to say that that piece that you read about his talk about the body deteriorating reminded me of, it felt to me like the other side of the coin of not self. I'm reading Guy Armstrong's book on emptiness, and I always thought of not self as an absence of a fixed self. And yet hearing that perspective from you and from Thich Nhat Hanh makes me realize it's not a nothingness, it's an everythingness.
Yeah.
The connection is with everything and everyone, and the interbeing is really the best definition I ever heard of not self.
Yeah.
So that was very healing also. I just felt very comforted by everything you shared, so I thank you.
Well, yeah, I'm pleased, Patty, that, particularly with the losses, to bring that perspective out yet more fully. It's quite something to keep with that perspective. And yeah, and I also agree that having that sense of interbeing really can be a, I don't know, I was going to say a more life-affirming interpretation of not self, not just focusing on the negation, but really seeing the implication. That's certainly what Thich Nhat Hanh did. You know, he really took interbeing as the, understanding of these very, very core teachings. And he did this in a way which I think could really, could communicate this teaching to children, right? That's amazing. He didn't say, "Children, I'm going to attempt to talk about emptiness now. Ready?" He said, "Can you see the cloud in the orange?" That's how he taught. Just very, very powerful, very direct, very simple, and yet very profound.
Yeah. Donald, there's a poem that you may remember better than I that I actually read at my mom's funeral that I'm being reminded of. It's by a Western woman, and "Don't stand by my grave and cry, I did not leave, I did not die. I am the birds and I am the sunlight." And I can't remember the whole poem. Do you know it?
I don't know if I do. I don't know it well in any case, but yeah, maybe I'd love to see it.
It's somewhere in my papers. I will find it and share.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. Maybe maybe we can have an interbeing poetry collection.
It's quite beautiful.
Yeah, great. Nancy, please.
Donald, I did the wrong emoji, and the emoji I kept doing was of clapping. So I think it was, first of all, it was unconscious for clapping for you, for your talk, but I meant to raise my hand, raising my hand emoji. You know, I was one of those 1970s activists with a lot of anger. And in the peace movement, I began to see my own anger and the anger of a lot of people around me. And there was a lot to be angry about, but I realized that some of my own anger was displaced. Mm. It was anger I hadn't come to terms with from my own past.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went about that after the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
I'm left with a question, though. I am struggling with my anger with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And I wonder what Thich Nhat Hanh or you would have to say about interbeing with what I consider to be a very dangerous man and how to interbe with that.
It is something I've reflected a lot about anger and about that kind of question. And I think it's a deep question, and anger is a very confusing emotion often, because, you know, historically it's both been criticized, and also some of the great exemplars of culture have manifested anger in a way, in almost in a sacred way. So we think of the Jewish prophets being angry, or Jesus with the money changers, or of course, even God gets angry. And yet we have anger as the one of the seven deadly sins, and a lot of condemnation of anger. So first of all, I think it's good to know that there's a lot of confusion about it. Personally, I think that it's the core issue is how one works with anger and how one transforms anger. Dr. King actually said that the transformation of anger is at the center of our movement, right? So it's like a lot of, you know, anger, and again, in many Western traditions, anger and injustice is in a sense justified. But then it's a question of what one does and whether one, how one works with it internally. Dr. King worked with it through the prism of love and prayer, you know, and for Thich Nhat Hanh, it's through the prism, we might say, of mindfulness and a sense of interbeing. And so the key is really the practice of being with anger. How can we be with anger with mindfulness, bringing in compassion? And my own experience is, you know, and I talk at some length on this in the book I did, The Engaged Spiritual Life. There's a whole chapter on anger. And, you know, I talk about a retreat where I was angry for about 16 or 18 hours a day for 10 days in a row and practiced mindfulness the whole time with it, you know, at this retreat. And what I came to see is that, you know, as many psychologists say, anger is a kind of a cover emotion. That when we actually stay with mindfulness, with anger, eventually it will disclose often sadness and grief. And then even beneath the sadness and grief, we can find love. You know, and so that's helpful to know, you know, that that a lot of our anger at injustice, actually the deeper motivation is wanting there to be justice and wanting there to be care and a good society. But the anger can cover that up. That's where the mindfulness and the working in a transformative way with anger is so crucial, hanging out with it. And it's not always very quick. But that I think is what's called for. And so when we do that, and again, in terms of having a sense of interbeing with the former president, I think we can see that as something that in terms of degrees of difficulty is hard, but can we do this practice of interbeing when we're angry with someone in our family or someone where it's not so hard to come to that transformative understanding? And so I think that's very much like I would like to see it, that developing a sense of interbeing with the former president is possible, but I would see it as part of a sequential training, and always training helps us to develop that kind of understanding where it's easier, you know, with other people. And then when we've got good at it, we could practice with the former president and maybe come to some of the understandings similar to those of Thich Nhat Hanh with President Bush, right? Invading the, you know, so it's really about, I think, being mindful, seeing the causes and conditions, And it's helpful to read some of the exemplars like Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, read the, read the writings of Dr. King and see how he came to a sense of interbeing with people who were his opponents, right? And often had a sense of empathy, but see that as something that isn't necessarily something that comes easily or quickly, and that we have to, as it were, build the muscle with less intense forms of anger just in our everyday lives. Can you have a sense of letting go of anger towards the driver who cuts you off? You know, or someone, again, maybe in your family or a coworker. So I hope that gives some direction, Nancy. So it's see it as part of a training, and we don't go to the most difficult way to manifest it first. We have to keep training.
Thank you. Very helpful, Donald.
Yeah, thanks.